Why Chronicles, you say? And, well, you might ask. Well, I suppose the short answer would be it's part of the Bible. And I fail to see how any part of the Bible can really be written off. I believe that we impoverish ourselves a bit by neglecting some of these more obscure parts of the Bible. We concentrate on the favourite passages. Quite frankly, I think that Chronicles has got a lot to offer. After all, it does have, altogether, 65 chapters in the two books. And I think that within those chapters there's an awful lot of good stuff for us. Now, it's unfortunate, the name is pretty unfortunate to start with, but it's also unfortunate that when you start to read it, the first nine chapters of the first book are boring, boring, boring lists of names. And that's enough then to turn people off, and so they put the book away and says, oh goodness me, it's just lists of names. Well, let me assure you that after you get past those nine chapters, that's it. You don't get those boring lists of names. Oh, you do get one or two here and there, but not slabs and slabs of the stuff like that. So that's not really very much, is it, out of 65 chapters? And the rest of the book is full of some very interesting material. Now, a lot of people think that the book of Chronicles is nothing but a parallel to the books of Samuel and Kings, and you get the same stories written twice. Well, let me assure you that that is not at all the case, and I hope to demonstrate that as we go through. Now, generally speaking, 1 Chronicles approximately equals 1 and 2 Samuel, and 2 Chronicles approximately equals 1 and 2 Kings. Certainly, there are lots of stories that are common to the books. That is, the stories in Samuel and Kings that you also find in Chronicles. But they are by no means simple repetitions. Chronicles has a flavour all of its own, and to be quite honest, the book turns me on a bit. When I really get into it, I find that it's full of the most fascinating material, and it's got a slant and an objective and a whole tone about it that really makes it a very meaty and a very instructive and a thoroughly enjoyable book. Be that as it may, 65 chapters and all the rest of it, I'm still going to do the whole book in one talk. Just to let me give you in a nutshell, the reason for the book. If you can cast your minds back to the time of the kingdom in Israel, you'll remember that after Solomon, the kingdom split in two. Remember, Solomon died and then his son Rehoboam came to the throne, and then the kingdom split between Jeroboam in the north and Rehoboam in the south. And from that time on, there were two kingdoms. Northern kingdom, which still called itself Israel, but was really a breakaway and had for most of its time Samaria as its capital. It consisted of 10 tribes. That's the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom, which had only two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, continued the Davidic rule. The Davidic kings, the kings in the line of David, continued to reign in Jerusalem over this southern kingdom, which now called itself Judah. Well, in due course, both kingdoms got themselves into an awful lot of bother. They departed from God, the northern kingdom particularly. Eventually, the northern kingdom was conquered and the people taken into captivity in Assyria. After that, the people of the northern kingdom were scattered, and largely they lost their national identity. That really is, you might say, the end of those 10 tribes. They just tended to disintegrate and were absorbed, more or less, into the surrounding nations. The southern kingdom kept on going for a while back there in Palestine, but over the years, about 605 to 587 BC, the southern kingdom was conquered by Babylon, and the people taken into captivity in Babylon. But the difference was that these people retained their national identity. They hung together as a people. And after they had been in captivity for around about 70 years, Babylon was conquered and the new ruler, Persia, gave permission for these Jews to return to their homeland and rebuild the nation. And you find that they did return around about the year 538 BC. And it's for these people who were returning to the land that the writer of Chronicles writes these books. The people are largely the people of Judah and Benjamin. They are going back to re-establish their national life. Now, of course, many of the people had been born and bred in captivity. The nation had been in captivity about 70 years. So many of the people born and bred in captivity would have known nothing about their homeland. But the writer of Chronicles writes for these people. And he wants to tell them that they are more than just a collection of slaves, a collection of exiles who are returning to their homeland or the homeland of their forefathers. He wants to tell them that they are a continuation of that pre-captivity community. They are a continuation of the ancient nation that came down through Moses and Joshua and David. Therefore you find there is a twofold basis to the book. Now once you have this clearly in your mind, you find that the book of Chronicles suddenly takes on a bit of interest. The twofold basis on which the nation must be reconstructed. Firstly, the basis of the Davidic dynasty. That, he says, is the only dynasty. The only kings entitled to rule are the kings of the line of David who rule in Jerusalem. That's the first basis. And the second basis concerns the religion. The only legitimate religion is the religion as carried on by the Levites and through the priests, the family of Aaron, at the temple in Jerusalem. Those are the two main features. The rule of the dynasty of David in Jerusalem and the operation of the religion through the Levites and the priests again at the temple in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the only legitimate capital. The temple in Jerusalem is the only legitimate place of worship. The Davidic kings are the only legitimate rulers. The Levites and the priests are the only legitimate religious officials. And that is the thrust of this man's book. And so what he wants to do is to show that in the past, that was the way the nation should have been. When it was that way, it went well. When it got off those essential items, it went wrong. He wants to show the importance of the priests, the Levites, the temple, Jerusalem, the dynasty of David. He emphasizes all these things to show that those are the things that held the nation together in the past. When those things were ignored or trampled upon, the nation fell apart. Therefore, now that these people from Babylon are going back into the land to rebuild the nation, to rebuild the temple, to reconstruct the whole of their national life, they must construct it all upon that same basis if they are to have God's blessing. Now you find that for this reason, in the books of Chronicles, very, very little is said of the northern kingdom. That is the breakaway kingdom that Jeroboam had in the north, the 10 tribes that hived off. He considers them not even worthy to be called a kingdom. He doesn't refer to their rulers as kings. He doesn't refer to he hardly refers to Israel at all, because it was a breakaway group. It was breaking away from the nation, breaking away from David, breaking away from the temple in Jerusalem, and it was not fit even to be talked about. So you'll go through the whole of the two books of Chronicles and you'll hardly find any reference to the northern kingdom. Now that's remarkable, because when you read the books of Kings, all the way through you find the story alternates. The northern kingdom and then the southern kingdom, then the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. All the way through it shows the history of the two nations. But in Chronicles, he concentrates on the southern kingdom. And he even calls Judah Israel, because Judah is the only legitimate Israel as far as he's concerned. And even though the northern kingdom in the book of Kings is called Israel, the man in Chronicles doesn't worry too much about that, because he just ignores the northern kingdom, and as far as he's concerned, the only legitimate Israel is Judah in Jerusalem, constructed around the temple. Now once you know that, immediately those first 9 chapters of genealogies, lists of names, makes a bit of sense. It's still not a great incentive to study them, I admit, but at least it makes sense. And after all, please remember, the Bible was written for other people besides us. Now, it may not be of much interest to me who was the father of who and who was the son of somebody else way back then, but it was very important to them, and it was written for them. So let's not be too selfish in this. It's also of interest to me as I read back into the history, because it tells me something about the people who returned. And I find as I read those 9 chapters that great detail is given concerning the Levites, the priests and the Levites. Incidentally, you know that the priests are just one family within the tribe of the Levites. The family of Aaron was one family in the tribe of Levi, and it was the family of Aaron, those descendants who were the priests, and the rest of the Levites were, of course, the other religious officials. The priests offered the sacrifices and went into the temple and all that sort of thing, and then the Levites were the general people who conducted all the religious service. What was I talking about? That's right, the genealogies, the list of names, great detail concerning the Levites, and the other great detail concerns Judah. specifically the family of David and to a lesser extent the tribe of Benjamin, because they were the ones who belonged to the southern kingdom. And what the writer of Chronicles wants to do is to show who in the nation inherits the religious duties, the priests and the Levites, who in the kingdom belongs to the royal family, the line of David. So that accounts for those first nine chapters. As we leave those nine chapters behind and go on to the bulk of the story, we notice a number of omissions and a number of additions. That is, when you compare Chronicles with the stories in Samuel and Kings. Firstly, the things that you read about in Samuel and Kings that you don't read about in Chronicles, things that the chronicler omits. I'll go through these very briefly, but you'll see the significance. He says almost nothing about Saul, because as we all know, Saul was not God's choice. God's choice was David, and the dynasty was established through David, not through Saul. Saul was from a different tribe, and he was not the person that God really wanted in control of Israel. So he doesn't say anything about Saul except to mention his death, and then he only mentions his death as a means of getting David on the stage. When you come to the life of David, you find a whole lot of things that are mentioned in Kings are omitted. Whole slabs, chapter after chapter after chapter, the chronicler omits them. For example, the story of Bathsheba, he omits it. All the things that followed Bathsheba, all David's family troubles, Amnon and Tamar and Absalom, the murder and the adultery and the rebellion within his own family, all of that, it's omitted. Because the chronicler is not concerned with interesting people, with getting people interested, that is. He's not concerned with getting people interested in all the details of David's family. What he wants to do is to show how the dynasty was established and how it passed on. Now, all the dead ends that came along the road, like Adonijah's rebellion, there's another one incidentally, Adonijah's rebellion is not mentioned, Absalom's rebellion isn't mentioned, Sheba, his rebellion, that's not mentioned, all the troubles in David's family, they're not mentioned, because they are not part of the author's purpose. He wants to show how David established his throne, established the dynasty, established the religion, and then passed it on to Solomon. Solomon was the legitimate heir, so all these other people are missed out. And when you come to Solomon, likewise you find certain omissions. Solomon's idolatry, which is majored upon in Kings, in Chronicles, it's omitted, because the writer wants to show that Solomon continued David's dynasty. The writer is not concerned with the failures of individuals, such as the failures of Solomon. He's concerned to point out to these exiles who are about to go back to their land that the real kingdom is that which came through David, established in Solomon, the temple and all the rest of it, and so all these other things he misses out. Likewise, you come to Jeroboam, the man who broke away from David's kingdom. Jeroboam is mentioned only incidentally, only to show that the kingdom of the north broke away, except that he doesn't call it a kingdom. The tribes broke away, they rebelled. And having mentioned it very briefly, nothing more is heard of it. No more mention of Jeroboam or the northern kingdom. Likewise, you come to Jezebel and Ahab, and then how Elijah and Elisha were brought in by God to counter the effect of Jezebel and Ahab. Now, in the books of Kings, there's a large section, I think it takes up around about 15 or 16, 17 chapters. When you come to Chronicles, not a word about Jezebel's Baalism or Elijah and Elisha. In fact, the writer mentions the northerners only if he wants to show that they were responsible for leading the kings of Judah astray, because it is true that sometimes the northern kings were responsible for the southern kings being led astray. It's only in adverse circumstances such as these that the writer even mentions the north, and because that's rubbing it in a bit more, showing that the Davidic kings, the kings of Jerusalem, departed from God when they got sidetracked by these rebels from the north. So much for the omissions. But now the additions, things that the man in Chronicles talks about that you don't find talked about in Samuel and Kings. Great emphasis in Chronicles on the religious organization in the time of the monarchy, that is, under David. David was the man who arranged the temple services. He organized the priests and the Levites. He arranged for singers, for musicians. He got choirs going in the temple worship. He planned for the future construction of the temple. He drew up plans for the temple. He got materials ready. There's a whole area of great detail in the book of Chronicles telling us how David organized the religious institutions of Israel. And the Levites, who are hardly mentioned anywhere in the books of Kings, are mentioned repeatedly, chapter after chapter, in the books of Chronicles, because they were the ones who were responsible for the religious life. And the writer of Chronicles wants to emphasize this to the people who are going to go back and re-establish themselves in the land. Another thing, the reforms of the Davidic kings. Now, many of the kings of David's line got off the track, and then other kings came along and carried out great reformation. Those reformations are all mentioned in Kings, but they are given in great detail in Chronicles. And they're fascinating detail too. It's not boring detail. It's really interesting to find how those kings really reformed the place. It wasn't just a case of straightening up the religion, but it concerned the judiciary, it concerned the education, it concerned the administration, it concerned the army, it concerned lots and lots of things. And always, the priests and the Levites are in the forefront of the Reformation. I'm going to give some details on that in just a moment. But those are the things that really give the book of Chronicles its real flavour. Now, just to go through some of these details, these are statistics, and the statistics don't prove everything, but it will give you an indication of the difference in emphasis between Samuel, Kings on one hand, and Chronicles on the other. Let us start with David. In the books of Samuel, there are 21 chapters concerned with David's civilian affairs, and only 3 chapters concerned with his religious affairs. In Chronicles, there are 7 chapters concerned with his civil affairs, but 12 chapters concerned with religious affairs. See the difference? 21 chapters of civil affairs in Samuel, but only 7 chapters on civil affairs in Chronicles. Only 3 chapters in Samuel concerning religious affairs, but 12 chapters in Chronicles concerning religious affairs. The duties of the priests and the Levites, the singers, the musicians, the plan of the temple, the materials for the temple, all that sort of thing in Chronicles. And now to look at the reforms, just look at these reforms of the different kings. The first one you read about is Asa, the king Asa, A-S-A, one of the kings of Judah. In the book of Kings, his reform takes up less than half a chapter, but in the book of Chronicles it gets 3 chapters. The next reform was carried out by Jehoshaphat. This was a very interesting reform. In Kings, it gets 1 chapter, but in Chronicles, it gets 4 chapters. It tells us all sorts of interesting things about the administration of the country, about the operation of the civil service, about the law courts, about how justice was administered, and it really gives us great insight into the way of life in those days. But the most difference is seen when you come to the man Hezekiah. Now, Hezekiah and Josiah were the other two great reformers, and there's a great parallel between the reforms of these two men. I'll just take the reforms of Hezekiah to give you the idea. He was the one that got rid of all the false worship and re-established the worship of God and instituted the Passover and things like that. When you read Kings, you find there are only 8 verses about the reforms of Hezekiah. Only 8 verses. But when you read Chronicles, you get 3 full chapters on his reforms. However, in Kings you get quite a bit about the civil rule of Hezekiah. He was the chap, remember, that the Assyrians came against Jerusalem and they mocked the Jews and they said, your God's a tin pot God and he can't do this and we're going to do all sorts of bad things to you. And Hezekiah tore his clothes and got very distressed. Well, all of that story about the civil affairs and the military affairs of Hezekiah take up 3 full chapters in Kings. But when you come to Chronicles, you get only 1 chapter on them. The whole thing is reversed, you see. Both things are reversed. The reforms, less in Kings, more in Chronicles. The civil things, more in Kings, less in Chronicles. And this is consistent all the way through the books. Finally, you come to the destruction of Jerusalem, B.C. 587, and all the events that led up to it in those last critical days in the reign of Zedekiah, the siege of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, and the ultimate collapse of Jerusalem and the deportation of people into captivity. When you come to the book of Kings, and there are 2 long chapters, and they give great details concerning the conquest. When you read in Chronicles, you get only 1 short chapter. He skips over the details of the conquest and simply comments on the reason for it. it's not really one of his favourite subjects, you see, because he doesn't want to give them all the details of how the nation fell apart and all the details of the conquest. These people he's writing for are about to go back into the land, and so he emphasises the reason why the land was conquered, because they departed from God. The warning, of course, to the people that he's writing for. Now, I hope that gives you a general picture. And what I'm going to do now is move through just, I think I've got, looks like 6 or 7 references here. And I have chosen what I would call references of lesser importance. I've given you the main slabs, and one could spend study after study after study going through the reigns of Asa, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah, seeing what the book has to say, the book of Chronicles has to say. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to concentrate on a few of the odd verses here and there that are just dropped into other stories, most of which I haven't mentioned, to get my point across. Okay, we'll whip through very quickly. 1 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 15. We'll go in chronological order. This is the story. Remember the story of a chap called Uzzah. David was shifting the ark to Jerusalem, and he had it on a cart, which he shouldn't have been doing. And it wobbled a bit and was going to fall off, and an unfortunate chap called Uzzah put his hand on it to stop it, and of course he was struck dead on the spot. David didn't know what to do, and so he left the ark there for 3 months. But after a while he decided to bring it again. But when he brought it the second time, he did it the way he should have done it in the first place. That is, he carried the ark on the shoulders of the Levites. That's the way it was written in the law of Moses. It wasn't done that way the first time, but now he does it properly. Now, the man in Kings doesn't mention that fact. He mentions that they had this misadventure and later on he was successful. But he doesn't give the reason. Chronicles gives the reason. It's important to him. Things have to be done according to the law of Moses, and the Levites and the priests are the only ones allowed to do the things allotted to them. Chapter 15, verse 15. The Levites carried the ark of God upon their shoulders with the poles, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. So you get the chronicler's emphasis. Go to chapter 28, verse 10. This is where David is handing over to Solomon. And you get a reference here that you don't get mentioned at all in Samuel or Kings. He says in chapter 28, verse 10, "Take heed now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it." The fact that David is passing on to Solomon this instruction for the temple in Jerusalem, and that Solomon is the chosen king to succeed David, that is a fact you don't get in Kings, but you get it very strongly here. Because, you see, it's part of the chronicler's approach. He wants to tie in the dynasty of David with the temple in Jerusalem. These things, to him, are inseparable. Go to 2 Chronicles chapter 8. This is a very interesting one. This is the nearest that the chronicler comes to mentioning Solomon's idolatry. 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 11. Do you remember that Solomon had lots of wives? He had one wife in particular, who was the princess from Egypt, Pharaoh's daughter. And in Kings we are told that Solomon built a palace for her. He built very many buildings in Jerusalem, and he particularly built a palace for his Egyptian princess. Chronicles adds a very important point. What's important for the chronicler? He wants to show that the reason that Solomon built this palace was to protect the temple from any suggestion of contamination from this foreign princess. Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David to the house which he had built for her. For he said, "My wife shall not live in the house of David, king of Israel, for the places to which the ark of the Lord has come are holy." The palace and the temple were very close to each other, and they were all within a great complex called the Great Court. But this palace for Pharaoh's daughter was removed, I would imagine, at the far end. Wherever it was anyway, it was certainly kept well distant from both the palace and the temple, because of Solomon's great concern to protect the temple from any suggestion of foreign contamination. The writer of the Chronicles doesn't mention all Solomon's idolatry, but yet he mentions this, and he almost, you might say, tries to paint Solomon in a good light by saying that the reason he had this separate palace was to just to make sure that nothing went wrong with the religion. He wanted to preserve the purity of Israel's religion. That's the chronicler's point. And of course, this is the lesson he wants the exiles to learn as they go back to Jerusalem, that they must preserve the religion intact, free from foreign influence. You come to chapter 11, and this one concerns the time immediately after the division of the kingdom. Solomon died, and then the kingdom split between his son Rehoboam in the south and the wicked Jeroboam in the north. And the chronicler now points out that Rehoboam did very well for the first 3 years. That's not even mentioned in the book of Kings. You get the impression from Kings that Rehoboam was utterly worthless. But when you read Chronicles, you find that that wasn't the case at all. For the first 3 years he did very well, mainly because he was helped by the priests and Levites. And the priests and Levites were not only those in and around Jerusalem, but the chronicler tells us that the genuine priests and Levites, the sincere ones, they would not tolerate this breakaway kingdom in the north. And they came from the north, refusing to worship Jeroboam's gods, and they migrated to Jerusalem, because that's the only place where you can worship. And because of this, Rehoboam in the south was strengthened. You see the point again, it's a very strong point he makes here. Verse 13. And the priests and the Levites that were in all Israel resorted to him, to Rehoboam, from all places where they lived. For the Levites left their common lands and their holdings and came to Judah and Jerusalem. He rubs it in a bit there. They came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam in the north and his sons cast them out from serving as priests of the Lord. He appointed his own priests for the high places and for the satyrs and the calves that he made. But verse 16, those who had set their hearts to seek the Lord, the God of Israel, they came after them, that is, they came after the true priests and Levites from all the tribes of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord, the God of their fathers. You see, he rubs it in every sentence, every phrase, to Jerusalem, the priests and the Levites, the Lord, the God of their fathers. That's where he is. And then he dismisses the northern people as being infidel. And so these people in verse 17, these priests and Levites that came, they strengthened the kingdom of Judah, and for 3 years they made Rehoboam the son of Solomon secure, for they walked for 3 years in the way of David and Solomon. He then goes on to point out that when they departed from that way, Rehoboam got into trouble. Now flip over, if you will, to chapter 23. This is a very good story here. It's the story of Joash, the boy Joash. I'll just give you the details here. Jezebel in the north and Ahab, her husband, between them produced a woman called Athaliah. And Athaliah married the king of Judah. When the king of Judah died, his son succeeded him. The son was killed, whereupon Athaliah seized the throne for herself. And through her, Jezebel's Baalism, which had been such a problem in the north, now invaded Judah. She immediately killed all the royal family, all her grandchildren. Nice grandma, this one. She killed all her grandchildren except one who escaped, spirited away by the priest Jehoiada. And that boy was Joash. And Jehoiada the priest, the emphasis is that he's a priest, he then planned a coup, a counter coup, and in due course they overthrew Athaliah. When you read the book of Kings, there is no mention at all of the priests and Levites. It mentions that the coup took place on the Sabbath when there was a double temple guard available. As the guard was changing over, the one that was going off duty and the one that were coming on duty combined. This was all planned so that there was a double force of troops there. But you get the impression that they're just ordinary civil troops from reading Kings. But when you read Chronicles, you find that these temple guards, temple officials, are all Levites. The whole chapter emphasizes that it was the Levites that did this. It was the Levites who did that. And although the coup was carried out at the temple two or three times, the writer of Chronicles goes out of his way to say, but they didn't defile the temple. We made sure the soldiers didn't go inside because only priests and Levites can go inside the temple. It really is fascinating to see the difference in style. We'll just pick up a few things here, and once again you'll find how the writer of Chronicles rubs it in. He makes sure that he gets his money's worth. Chapter 23, or verse 1, tells us about Jehoiada the priest, and then verse 2, they went about through Judah and gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem. And all the assembly made a covenant with the king in the house of God. Notice it's with the king in the house of God in Jerusalem. All the time he is tying together king, temple, Jerusalem, Levites. You can't have one without the other. Jehoiada said to them, "Behold the king's son, let him reign as the Lord spoke concerning the sons of David." Verse 4, "This is the thing that you shall do. Of you priests and Levites who come off duty on the Sabbath, one third shall be gatekeepers, one third shall be at the king's house, and one third at the gate of the foundation. And all the people shall be in the courts of the house of the Lord." But verse 6, "Let no one enter the house of the Lord except the priests and ministering Levites. They may enter, for they are holy. But all the people shall keep the charge of the Lord. The Levites shall surround the king, each with his weapon in his hand, and whoever enters the house shall be slain." So here again you see that picture of great concern for the holiness of God's temple. It comes out again in verse 18. "Jehoiada posted watchmen for the house of the Lord under the direction of the Levitical priests and the Levites whom David had organized to be in charge of the house of the Lord." Sentence after sentence, chapter after chapter, the organization of the Levites, which David had carried out, was legitimate, and they were the ones who were to operate in the temple, in conjunction with the Davidic king. "As it is written in the law of Moses," he goes on to say in verse 18, again saying that all this is according to the law laid down. Verse 19, "He stationed the gatekeepers in the gates of the house of the Lord, so that no one should enter who was in any way unclean." Same emphasis, protecting the house of the Lord. Go to chapter 26, verse 16, and here we meet the man Azariah, or Uzziah, or Azariah. He was one of the greatest of Judah's kings in terms of prosperity and national development. And we read again something here that you don't read in Kings. None of these details we've read here are anywhere in the book of Kings. The detail here is in verse 16, and it's a very important detail for the writer of Chronicles. "When he was strong, Uzziah, he grew proud to his destruction, for he was false to the Lord his God and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense." The point is this: the kingship and the priesthood were separate, and one was not to encroach upon the territory of the other. The Davidic king and the Levitical priests were to work in harmony. The priests were not to do the king's job, the kings were not to do the priest's job. And when you get this king presuming to do the priest's job, he is destroyed. A very important point for these returning exiles to keep in mind. We come to chapter 36, our last section, and this now concerns the destruction of Jerusalem. Zedekiah is the last king. Once again, notice the emphasis. All the emphases that I'm going to draw your attention to are not in the book of Kings. Verse 11, "Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet." Good point here. The importance of Jeremiah. The king did not listen to the message from God. Jeremiah spoke from the mouth of the Lord. Verse 13, "Zedekiah rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by God. He stiffened his neck and he hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel." The king must be obedient to God. Verse 14, "All the leading priests," mention again, all the leading priests and the people, "likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of the Lord which he had hallowed in Jerusalem." Again, his concern for the purity of the temple. Verse 15, "The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people, on his dwelling place. But they kept mocking the messengers. They despised their words. They scoffed at the prophets, till the wrath of God was poured out upon them." The reasons here, which you don't get in Kings, this man makes a great point of it. The people of God have got to be faithful to the law of God, be faithful to the temple procedures, to the priests, to the Levites. The king has got to be obedient if they're going to be God's people at all. And verse 20, "In the end he took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So now he says Jeremiah had forecast that the nation would go into captivity for 70 years, and now it happened. And now you come to the reason that he wrote his book, because the people are now returning to their land. And it's for these returning people that the chronicler gives all the instructions. And so he brings us now right up to the time when he is writing in verse 22. The first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Persia conquered Babylon in 538 BC, and that's the year he talks about here. That the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it in writing, and this is what he said. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him, let him go up. And that's the end of the book. So, says the writer of Chronicles, let them go up. Build the temple, reconstitute the priesthood, make sure you are following the law of God, make sure that the king is a Davidic king, that he is loyal to God, that he follows the procedures of the temple, that he does not transgress into the responsibilities of the priests. Follow these things, he says, and God will be with you. But take also heed of the lessons from the past. Because when those kings departed from those guidelines, always it brought disaster. Now you're going back there, he says. You learn the lessons, and you make sure that you follow in the paths of God. And there, I believe, if you want to follow them through, are some very good lessons for us, particularly in that last chapter, where he talks about the danger of ignoring the message from God, the danger of ignoring the law which he gave through his prophets, through his servants, through his lawgivers, through his priests, through his Levites. Ignore these to your peril. Obey them, and you will enjoy the blessing of God. And that, very briefly, is the message of the two books of Chronicles.